Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Joining me today is Richard Lee, councillor for the City of Burnaby, and Lisa Codd, who's part of Burnaby staff. And we're here to talk about a project the city is undertaking to issue an apology to its Chinese Canadian community over past policies and laws that the city of Burnaby enacted in the past century that were quite discriminatory. Perhaps we can start up, you can tell me what was the genesis of this project and why now?
All right, thank you for the opportunity to answer that question. The city for quite a number of years now, starting mainly around 2017, has been actively researching Chinese Canadian history in Burnaby and sharing that information with the public. And part of that research surfaced past discriminatory policies and practices of our local government in Burnaby. And as a result, a community group, the Burnaby Intercultural Planning Table, in cooperation with the Coalition Against Racism, contacted our municipal council and suggested that we undertake a process like this. Council was very supportive of that suggestion, and so we're proceeding.
Right. So the whole project is about more than just an apology. There's an effort to do research and compile the history of these policies and but also to engage the community in the discussion. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I think it's important when you're apologizing to someone that you are also connecting to ensure that apology is meaningful and that actions are taken in support of the apology. Similar apology processes at the City of Vancouver and New Westminster as well have included community engagement work to consult with the community, raise awareness of the issues, and also to identify legacy actions such as commemoration project that can support ongoing engagement with the community.
So what kind of policies, what kind of things have been discovered through this process? I've heard about some of them and they're kind of eye-opening in some cases.
Yeah, and there's still research to do. I think we're in our preliminary stage with our research, but there's a number of ways that as a local government, Burnaby discriminated against people of Asian descent. So some of those included joining advocacy efforts of other municipalities to try to exclude Asian immigration, for example. And some of those other actions targeted Chinese businesses. So bylaws that restricted trade licenses for greengrocers and piggery operators, which were a couple of the common businesses that Chinese Canadians had in the early part of the 20th century. And we also are the fourth bylaw. So this was a priority of Burnaby's early municipal council. The fourth bylaw enacted by Burnaby restricted employment of Asian Canadians by the local government or by anyone contracting services to the local government. And that bylaw remained in effect until 1953.
Yeah, I read another story about a bylaw that was proposed by a Vancouver-based chapter of the KKK and then adopted, well, maybe not a bylaw, but a policy adopted by Burnaby and I presume other municipalities in the area.
Yeah, so sometimes groups like the KKK advocated for discriminatory policies, and they would write to various levels of government and ask them to endorse their efforts. And yeah, our council did endorse those efforts. If I'm remembering them right, that was an effort to exclude Asian immigration.
It's interesting because we've heard a lot over the number of years about the policies put forth at the national and the provincial level. It's really interesting to see these similar things having happened at the municipal level. I guess in many ways, not really surprising, but it really is interesting to see what was going on. And I think one of the things about municipal governments that they have, in many cases, so many more points of contact with their citizens on even a daily basis that these kind of policies put in at the municipal level can be in many ways more impactful.
Yeah, and I'm sure that Councillor Lee could definitely speak to sort of the layers of discrimination by all levels of government that took place in the past.
Thank you. As you know, and many people know that the federal government naturally had the Chinese Exclusion Act at that level. So from early, probably 1885 1923, the head tax was imposed to the Chinese community at that time. And actually, my grandfather paid for the hack tax in 1913 to get into Canada as a farmer. So at that time, the hack tax was imposed starting from $50 and increasingly, quickly increased to 100 and then went up to $500. I heard that at that time, $500, you can buy two building lots in Chinatown, Vancouver. Yeah. So that's a lot of money to pay back. So I think over the years, this kind of discriminatory policy had been redressed in the federal level in the 2007, and then provincially, we also did a recognition 2013-14 in that period, so that those discriminatory laws in the province level, we take out quite a few of those injustice law in the legislature in DC, and then redress that. We also just heard that, Vancouver, of course, had redressed that, and New West did that as well. So I think this is a time between Vancouver and New West, Burnaby. We are going to do something on that front. So I'm very pleased to hear that. This is one page of a dark history in Canadian history. We would like to see what kind of laws and bylaws in the city level that had been passed or implemented. So I think this is a good way as 100 years of the Chinese Exclusion Act. Because after 1923, the city, the whole country actually implemented that federal law to ban actually immigration for the ordinary Chinese to come to Canada. So to 1923. Until 1947, after the Second World War, because of the Chinese veterans, their contribution to defending Canada's value, as well as went to the war for Canada, that the Canadian government actually saying that now you can vote, you can have Canadian citizenship, that kind of thing. So I think For 100 years, I think this is a day that we should commemorate and see that those discriminatory laws won't see their lives again in the future.
So, I mean, what does it feel like to you personally as a member of the Chinese community to learn about these kind of policies enacted by the city you now represent on council?
Yeah, the KKK resolution passed by the council, endorsement by the council at that time. That was the first, I mean, I just heard about that a few months ago. So those are new to me. And I think some of those histories we need to learn more as a community to see what kind of actually bylaws will pass as a city. So I think it would be interesting that our next generation will learn about the history and also the community itself. We see that now we are really fortunate to live in a harmonious society. We should treasure our position, our daily life, and also the rights and freedom in this good Canadian society.
Have you heard from members of the community in response to this initiative?
It's from the newspaper, the Chinese Canadian newspaper. They also publish news about this initiative from Burnaby. They are supportive. I believe also there are some people would like to be sitting in the committee as well to see how they can contribute to this process. We learned that Burnaby also will be publishing a book about Chinese Canadians in the city, and the community is really positive on seeing the result of that book, the contents, etc. So I think thanks to the city staff and the council, and they look into this issue and very supportive of these initiatives.
In many ways, all these bylaws and policies and regulations enacted by the city and the other level governments must have really only been, in many ways, the tip of the iceberg, because when all the levels of government are putting in these kinds of policies and whatnot, that must really have emboldened individuals and even, you know, people working for the city to express and act on their racist attitudes. So you mentioned it, a dark period in history. You know, it spreads out and becomes bigger than just a matter of policy and bylaw. So what's the timeline for the completion of the project?
We will be going out to consult with the community in the fall and also in 2024, and we're expecting the formal apology in 2025. It's important to take the time to do the consultation and that engagement with the community. And some of this information is a surprise to members of the community. So I think we need to take the time to be able to get the word out about what happened and what is happening.
When it is offered, what will the apology look like? Will there be a public ceremony, or has that been determined yet?
That is something we'll work with the community on. I think every community will have its own desire of what they want that apology to look like, in terms of the level of formality, the languages that it needs to be delivered in, the place where it might be delivered in. So there's still a lot that we want to work out, but we want to make sure that we're engaging with the community to make those decisions.
And will there be any lasting legacy or a public display or memorial?
So that also is something that will come out of the consultation to find out what the legacy project might look like. Although, I mean, the city, as Councillor Lee mentioned, has taken on a number of projects to commemorate Chinese Canadian history in Burnaby, including a book that will be published later this year. And I think it's just important to remember that though we're talking about this incredible web of racism and discriminatory policies from all levels of government, including several local governments, that there's also these stories of incredible resilience of the Chinese Canadian community members. So we want to make sure we're also telling those stories of resilience and the way that community members contributed. And in Burnaby, a lot of that contribution was growing food. Chinese Canadian farmers grew, despite restrictions on land ownership, were able to farm an incredible amount of food that fed the region. Actually, Councillor Lee's family was a farm family as well.
Actually, the Leung's family, they still operate in the South Burnaby. The Leung's family, they had a market garden in the Musqueam land, reserve land, near Dunbar and Marine Drive. My grandfather actually farmed in that Musqueam reserve land for almost 30 years as a partner in the market garden. And so they leased the land from the First Nations and with a partner. And one time there are over, I think, 20 market gardeners in that area. So I heard many stories about the market gardeners. Larry Grant, senior elder in that community, told me a lot of stories, and including he was playing in the Hong Kong Garden, the Market Garden, and then that's our interaction with my grandfather. So I think that's some of the stories to tell. Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining me today. I think this is a really important project, and as we've seen from what has come forth so far, there's a lot of stuff that people did not know about, and it's important to shine a light on those things, and it's really great to see Burnaby doing this. Thank you for joining me today, Lisa Codd, with the City of Vancouver, and Richard Lee, Councillor, with the City of Burnaby.
All right. Thank
Lisa
you.
Codd and Richard Lee, Councillor with the City of Burnaby, both with the City of Burnaby. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, pleasure talking to you.
This is Bird Note. Even if the name Spix Macaw doesn't ring a bell, you might recognize this bird. It's Blue from Rio, the animated film.
But he's about to discover how rare he really is. Blue is the last male of his kind.
I have a kind?
Also known as the little blue macaw, they're medium-sized birds with a gray head, intense blue plumage, and a black and robust beak. But the most characteristic feature of these macaws is their voice, a short and raspy "Grr!" However, by the late 2000s, the bird's voice went silent. They were considered extinct in the wild. Since the 19th century, Spix macaws have been hunted for the pet trade. They lost much of their habitat, the Caatinga, a semi-arid region in northeastern Brazil. To make matters worse, an introduced bee species competed with them for nesting sites. A group of Brazilian and German conservationists saved a few individuals. They began a captive breeding program with just 7 birds. But after 20 years of breeding, success! Biologists raised the captive population to nearly 200 macaws. They had to be trained to fly, find food, and recognize predators in the wild. In 2022, the Spix Macaw Release Project set free 52 individuals into their ecosystem in Brazil. Their distinctive voice rang out again in the Caatinga. For Bird Note, I'm Lucina Melesio.
Witness the world's best cinema, meet the creators behind your favorite works, and encounter live shows that combine music and film at the Vancouver International Film Festival. Taking place from September 28th to October 8th, a stellar lineup of over 130 films from 70 countries will transport you to places you've never been. Embrace the magic of cinema with exceptional storytelling that leaves you captivated and inspired. Be in the room as VIFF Live shows breathe life into stories from the screen, combining live performance and cinema. And go behind the scenes with VIFF Talks, connecting you to the brilliant minds behind the work you love. Explore the program and get tickets now at VIFF.org. That's VIFF.org. Student discounts are available, and if you are between the ages of 19 and 25, you can also join VIFF's free U25 membership program.
Hello, my name is Chris Spangenberg, and you are listening to CGSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Vancouver, Burnaby Mountain. This is the second interview out of an 8-part episodic series on traditional Chinese medicine, also known as TCM, and the traditional Chinese medicine community here in Vancouver. In the course of these interviews, I examine the local culture and practice of traditional Chinese medicine, as well as inquire into its philosophy and difference from Western medicinal practices. This series is produced for CGSF 90.1 FM's Making Time for Radio project. In this interview, I'm talking with Darcy Carroll, an acupuncturist and clinic owner of Polk Community Acupuncture Clinic on Broadway. She's the local pioneer of the community acupuncture model, initially developed by the Working Class Acupuncture Organization in Portland, Oregon. We first talk about her personal background and how she ended up working with Chinese medicine. Afterwards, we get into her practice and her approach to healing, before we delve into the subject of community acupuncture, her involvement and its philosophy, as well as its difference from regular acupuncture. We end the interview looking at the changes that have taken place in Vancouver over the last 20 years regarding TCM, and we also look at the future of traditional Chinese medicine here in Vancouver. Please note that neither I nor Darcy is bashing Western medicine. In certain instances, we discuss the differences between Chinese medicine and Western medicine, but the illustration is meant to be functional, not ideological. My name is Chris Spangenberg, and you're listening to an interview between me and Darcy Carroll here on CGSF 90.1 FM. So Darcy, tell me a little about yourself and your history.
Well, I'm a Chinese medicine practitioner, and I'm also a mother and a clinic owner. I run Polk Community Acupuncture on Broadway in Vancouver.
How long have you been practicing as an acupuncturist?
I think I was licensed in 2005, and I did a few locums after graduation and worked as a private practitioner for a couple of years, and then I opened up Polk in 2009.
How did you become an acupuncturist?
I guess what led me to it, I was working in Central America. I'd done a degree in Caribbean Studies and Latin American Studies, and I was working in San Salvador, and I found it to be just a little bit overwhelming, disillusioning. I thought I was going to be working in sort of the more environmental, social justice, international development work, and it just wasn't quite meeting my expectations, I guess. So I came home from that, was a little bit burnt out and knew I still wanted to help people, but I just didn't know in what capacity. And so I talked to a few of my friends and found out that one of them was doing traditional Chinese medicine. And so I did a little bit of reading up on it, and I just thought it would be a good fit for me. You know, it reflected a lot of my beliefs and interests.
What benefits do you feel Chinese medicine holds?
Ooh, this one could take me a long time to answer. That's okay. I think many benefits, really. It's a homeostatic way of treating people. It really creates balance in the body. It's even though it sounds invasive with needles, I find it to be quite a gentle approach, or it can be quite a gentle approach, but really have a deep effect. So I just see a lot of issues resolve themselves with acupuncture.
How did you end up working with traditional Chinese medicine? What got you first interested in the field?
Well, I think, like I said before, I had a friend who was studying it. So I started reading up on it and just learning a little bit about what acupuncture is about. And yeah, it reflected a lot of my interests. So it was a huge leap of faith for me. It wasn't like I had a whole bunch of experience. In fact, I'd never had an acupuncture treatment before going to school. So yeah, quite the leap of faith. But here I am today, you know, many years later, still in the field.
When did you do your study?
Where? Sorry, did I do it or
yeah,
when?
Well, both where and when.
I did it in Victoria. At the time, it was the Canadian College of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine. So it was the first school in Canada, but it has since closed. And I started in 2000, 2001 maybe, and completed in 2005, I think it was, 2004 or 2005.
What is your approach to healing?
I really like to look at the whole body and listen to a patient's complaints and see how those symptoms manifest in their body. And I like to take into consideration the mind and the body. And in Western medicine, there's a real separation, you know, sort of Western rationalist thinking of breaking everything down to its finest component. But Chinese medicine works in a different you know, there's a paradox of nothing is absolute and there isn't really a break between mind and body. So I like to look at all of these things when I'm seeing a patient.
How do you see each patient in terms of their condition, given what you've just said?
Well, I think everybody can manifest in a slightly different way. So, for instance, I can have four people in one day walk in with headaches, and they can all manifest in a different way, even though, you know, they might say I have a headache. It can look different for each person. So I just have to see how it does manifest for each of my patients and then sort of treat accordingly.
What is your personal philosophy behind your use of acupuncture?
Well, I like to diagnose on a meridian basis. So instead of looking at a Zongfu diagnosis, which is what we may have learned in school and I feel really applies to the herbal component of Chinese medicine, I look at the body and I ask where a patient's symptoms manifest. So where on the body can I find these symptoms? And then I treat it according to a meridian diagnosis. So I find out which meridian these symptoms fall on. And we have, you know, 12 meridians, for example, that run through our body that are attached to certain organ systems. And on each of those meridians, there's a number of points with different functions. And then we also have a number of other points on the body that aren't set like that, that are more personalized for each patient. So yeah, personally, I like to find out what meridian is affected. And then I choose a method of treatment that I've learned since being out of school, actually. I've studied with a doctor, Dr. Tan, an amazing master who unfortunately recently passed away, but I really adhere to his philosophies and his teachings.
In your opinion, what are the main differences between Chinese medicine and Western medicine?
Well, I know I touched briefly on that in the philosophy, or sort of when you're talking about sort of Western rationalism versus Chinese medicine and what sort of philosophies it was born from, but in a Western rationalist world, I think we break everything down to its finest components. We really try and understand it, put it in a box, you know. It's very logical and rational. Chinese medicine tends to look at things and looks at the body as a whole.